Look at my moves, don't they blow your mind? Drama and talent and sex combined. Hell, you could tell even if you're blind. See, I'm fabulous, baby. I'm meant to be where the spotlight shines. Born to be on display. Built to be dressed to the 99s and ready to stand and say hey.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 1st, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and also visitors Lucky and the Mick from the Craptacular website. Many of you out there haven't heard of the Craptacular, which is a youthful, mind occasionally snarky, moderately pointless website about Broadway. It was founded in 2010 by Lucky and the Mick. Lucky's a working writer and editor, and also an international jet setter. Look at that. The Mick is an online marketing maven and a redhead. They are recovering fangirls, and at the moment, they are both totally sober, but we haven't verified that. Hello, Lucky and the Mick. We are maintaining your anonymity so that you do not get fired from your jobs.
Thank you. Excellent. We appreciate it.
Great. Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com. Also writes for Masterworks Broadway and also for the Newark Star Ledger. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. He writes and photogs for Broadway Stars and for NPR.org. And you could see his photography at followspotphoto.com and lots of other things. And oh, we have to get that that story about Gerard Alessandrini together.
Oh, my God.
A minute at the end of the podcast, because you have written a book with him, haven't you?
Yes, yes, yes.
Tell me about the book quickly.
Oh, it's Forbidden Broadway Behind the Mylar Curtain.
I can't say Mylar. That's my problem.
Mylar, yeah. And it's a history of the show over its first 25 years. I think it's going to be back in New York not too far in the future. I'm not.
Maybe Carol Channing will be in it.
Yeah.
So let's jump in. We have five shows to cover right now. Sister Act, Normal Heart, Baby It's You, Born Yesterday, and House of Blue Leaves, and we have little time. So, Peter, why don't you get us started on Sister Act, because you have a great perspective to share with us about it.
Well, yes, I did see it 5 years ago in Pasadena. I did see it 2 years ago in London, and I did see it a couple of weeks ago here. So that was the third jewel of the Triple Crown. It's tremendously improved since Pasadena. I mean, there were things in Pasadena that astonished me that they did that I thought were really quite wrong. Well, especially the 11 o'clock number. The 11 o'clock number originally had the Mother Superior getting drunk, chugging from a bottle, and singing how through her life she's had to deal with quaaludes, the G-spot.
Oh, my God.
Edible panties. These are actually mentioned in the lyrics. I mean, this is not my interpretation. The words quaalude, G-spot, and edible panties were actually cited in the lyrics. Luckily, that song went very quickly. So that was the biggest improvement, getting rid of that. But there were other things that didn't quite land either. Have again mercifully been dropped. One of them that I thought was significant as well was the Sister Act song that was originally there. There is still a title song called Sister Act, where now Dolores Van Cartier, the woman who has witnessed a murder and is on the run and is hiding out in a convent, sings about how life has affected her here and how she's changed from a person who has been only interested in herself to somebody who's interested in helping others. But originally, the song Sister Act was sung by Mother Superior to Dolores, in which she doesn't believe that she is really somebody who's becoming sincere, somebody who's less interested in the secular life and more interested in the religious life. Nobody's falling for your Sister Act, she used to say to her. And also, looking for a rhyme for act, Mother Superior actually sang to her, let's hope you don't get whacked. Well, I'm not sure that that would be in her vocabulary. And worst of all, though, is when she eventually said, and shove your sister act up your, well, you know, I mean, she interrupts herself, I'll grant you, but still, I don't think she would get to the point where she would use such a vulgar expression. So, and what happened then, too, is that Dolores got became infuriated and threw a hymnal on the floor out of frustration and saying, sacred schmacred. And I don't think she would have even done that in her most vile aspects of her secular life. I mean, she's not that type of person who would do that. So I think by this point in the show, this was a second act song, she had acquired enough respect for a religious book that she wouldn't even consider defiling it. So so luckily, all that went. The show from London has been slightly changed, not a lot, but the reason I really kind of get behind the show is because I think of it as just a variation of nonsense where the supposed fun of the show is that we see nuns acting silly. And no question there's an audience for that. And the people who saw the show with me, around me, were having a wonderful time watching nuns be silly and priests be silly, too. I mean, one priest, you know, saying, let's give it up for, you know, when introducing somebody. And again, the idea of people acting in a way they wouldn't act strikes a lot of people as funny. It seems odd for me to say that I like realism in musical theater, given that musical theater itself is an unrealistic art form in the sense that people don't break out in song in real life. But nevertheless, I've always found the musicals I enjoy most the ones I can believe the most. And I just don't believe the behavior in Sister Act. So as a result, that's my problem with it. I also feel that Alan Menken has written a mostly pastiche score. And, you know, I don't blame him in the sense that when he's written pastiche, like for Little Shop of Horrors, he's done better on stage than he has when he's tried original musicals with original scores. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say original musicals, in the sense that some have been adaptations like God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater or The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. But his music for those two shows, and if you haven't heard of them, I understand. One played off-Broadway for a little while and one closed in Philadelphia. But I do happen to know those scores and I think the music is really wonderful. But when he does pastiche-type scores, he does better. So as a result, I don't blame him for really giving the public what it seems to want. I'm not even betting against Sister Act winning a whole bunch of Tonys, and certainly Bettina Miller makes a very nice Broadway debut, no question about that. But I just wish that so much of the humor weren't, oh, look at that, a nun wouldn't do that, and therefore it's funny. So Sister Act doesn't work for me as much as it will for the audience.
Peter, I almost feel as though that what you saw originally got ripped out of Sister Act and put into High and made into its own show.
You know, there's been a lot of nuns lately between High and, of course, House of Blue Leaves has nuns too. I'm telling
the
you.
The Divine Sister.
The Divine Sister. They're taking over, you know, and I'm not surprised. I mean, the nuns I had during my 12 torturous years of Catholic high school certainly were types that could take over and rule the world, or at least slap people into submission. You know, I mean, certainly happened with me. But that's another story, and we won't talk about that now.
Michael, tell us about Sister Act.
Well, I very much agree with what Peter said. There are ways that you can make fun of nuns and priests and religion. I think it's harmless for the priest to come out and sort of act like an MC and say things like give it up for the sisters and things like that. But then there are things like that are really kind of tasteless to me. And I have to say at the start, no one is more against organized religion than me, but that doesn't mean that you have to be tasteless and make fun of it in the way that so many people do, and in this show. I mean, there's a song that the three hench, the plot in a nutshell is that the lead woman is a club singer and she sees her boyfriend kill someone. And then she hides out in the convent in order to, a sort of like a witness protection thing. But anyway, at one point, her boyfriend has these three henchmen sort of, and they basically sing a song about how they're going to go to the convent and basically have sex with the nuns. you know. And then at the end of the show, the nuns appear. I don't remember if this happened in the movies. Maybe somebody can remind me. The nuns appear in like an incredibly gaudy version of their habit, like white with spangles, and it's like, well, you know, that symbolizes something, that habit. It's they would never ever do that, and it just becomes ridiculous and juvenile and infantile, and I just didn't respond to that at all.
Michael, indeed, in the movie they do not do that by any means.
They
are still in their traditional nun dress, and there they are, and they still have glorious looks on their faces, because the songs they are singing, "I Will Follow Him" and "My God" as opposed to "My Guy," don't cross the line at all. And the look on their face is still beatific. You know, "I Will Follow Him." Him has a different meaning now. They're not talking about a teenage boy as, what was it, Leslie Gore did. But but it's very effective to see these nuns just find a new way to express themselves. That's what this is, a new way to express themselves, as opposed to we succumb to show business.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that they didn't do that in the movie. I'd love to hear what you all think about, specifically about that song in which the three guys say, you know, that we're going to go and do the nuns, basically. It's just, you know, just really stupid. I mean, there were a lot of funny lines in the show from Douglas Carter Bean, who apparently, Peter can testify, supposedly practically rewrote the whole show from the ground up in terms of the actual dialogue. And Victoria Clark was amazing in it. And I was very pleased with Bettina Miller. I had heard some people say that they thought she was great in the singing, but not so much in the comedy. But the night I went, I have to tell you, she got all the laughs. So that was very pleasing to me. And I have one plot question maybe somebody could clear up for me, because it seems very sloppy. So Dolores sees this murder, and then she's brought into the convent to, you know, as a witness protection thing, basically. But then they keep saying, your court date is coming up. They're supposedly going to keep her in the convent until she can testify against her mobster boyfriend. But is that how it happens in real life? If you see a murder, do you testify in court against someone before, when the person is not in custody?
No, because you have to be in custody in order to be...
No, I mean, so what are they talking about? I don't understand it.
I guess what they're saying is when the court date is ready, I'm not sure, I don't know about the legalities of this, but I guess what they're saying is when the court date is ready, then they would apprehend him, I guess.
Well, all right, but he's at large. He's not, you know,
yes,
maybe,
yes,
maybe they won't apprehend him.
Right, know? Right, all set there. Okay. I'll sit there. I certainly agree with that. But what's interesting, too, in the movie is that they say the court date won't be for 2 months, maybe. Month or 2 months. Now, here they say a year. And then when they conveniently need it at the end of the show, they say, oh, good news, it's going to be Wednesday. We got it advanced.
Right.
So even that's a stretch.
Yeah.
Hollywood ending, as they say in City of Angels.
I guess, yeah.
All righty. So it's doing good box office. I think it's going to be with us for a little while and make me happy like Mamma Mia does. So, sorry, I seem to be on a Mamma Mia rant the last couple of weeks. All right. So going from...
the divine to something to else.
Something normal. Normal Heart opened up on Broadway. And Michael, why don't you give us an introduction on that?
Well, it's a really powerful, amazing, wonderful revival of a play, mid-80s play by Larry Kramer that was first done at the Public Theater in 1985, I believe, right at the beginning of the first really horrible growth of the AIDS crisis. I did see it then. It was an overwhelming experience, but at the time it was almost not a theatrical experience so much, because it was right in the thick of the crisis, and nobody knew what was going on. It was like watching TV almost, except the crisis wasn't being covered on TV. And it's about the central character is based on the author Larry Kramer. The character is called Ned Weeks, and he and a small bunch of his friends start to spread the alarm and form an organization to get the word out about AIDS, and they go to the mayor to try to get funding, but that falls on deaf ears. And the mayor is supposed to be Ed Koch, even though his name is not mentioned in the play. And it's just people dying one after the other. There's an incredible effect in this production where the names of the dead are shown on, projected onto the back wall of the theater near the beginning, and in increments. So first you see the toll, what it was in 1985, and then a few scenes later you see what it was in I'm sorry, not 1985. The action starts earlier, but through the years you see the toll growing to the point where at the end of the play, the production, and I guess this is not a spoiler because it's been covered by several reviewers, the names actually are so many of the dead that they overflow from the stage itself into the audience and projected on the walls of the theater. And it's really just a wonderful production. The play over the years has been, some people have said that it's agitprop. Well, it is agitprop, but also some people have said that it's not as effective as a play itself. And it was really just the political content of it that made it worthwhile. There is some truth to that, but as it turns out, it is so well written and the characters are so wonderfully drawn. And in this production and the other two that I saw, the acting is so extraordinary that it really must be seen. Joe Mantello, who has not, I believe, as far as I know, acted at all since the original Broadway production of Angels in America, is amazing as Ned Weeks, and John Benjamin Hickey gives an extraordinary performance as his the man, the New York Times writer who becomes Ned's lover. Also incredible in the cast are Ellen Barkin, who plays a doc. She's the one female in the cast, and she plays an AIDS doctor who's just incredibly frustrated by the lack of compassion and the lack of action on the part of politicos, and she has a monologue that just absolutely brings the house down. This furious monologue in which she castigates everyone, basically. Luke McFarlane, Patrick Breen, Jim Parsons from The Big Bang Theory, which is a TV show that I don't watch, but I'm going to start watching it now, is wonderful in a relatively small role. And Lee Pace also is in the show. The best that Broadway has to give us. And it's a revival that was very, very necessary, and always will be. I also was I was glad that not to get too political, but they do point out again how truly evil Ronald Reagan's lack of response of any type to the AIDS crisis was. I think Reagan has, for some incredible reason, tended to become beatified over the years since his death, and it's just not appropriate. There was a lot of blood on his hands, and this is a good reminder of that.
All right, so Lucky and the Mick, you saw this, and give us your take on it.
Sure. So I actually saw this week. I totally agree with everything Michael said. I think that this show is incredibly, incredibly powerful. I think my concern coming into it is that it would play a little bit kind of like a period piece. Like we would look at this and kind of see it as a piece of history. But I think that the thing that was really interesting about it is that I think we're in the midst of a health crisis in this country where we're completely reevaluating the ways that we approach, pay for, address the issue of health in America. And one of the lines that the Ellen Barkin character says is that she says that health is basically a right. And that was something that I was like, wow. I said, that's something that was part of the conversation when this show initially opened. And it's so completely a part of the conversation now. I mean, it struck me as so contemporary. So I thought that was really interesting, that there's nothing about this show that feels dated or like it's part of some distant past.
The gay marriage comment too.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's like, wow, this is something that's so completely relevant to things that we're, are so part of the national conversation today. I thought this was a wonderful play. There was a point in the second act that everyone around me was crying. I was crying because it describes in detail the way that people who had AIDS were treated. And at a point in time where the disease didn't have a name, when it was the presumption that the only people who got it were they were the outcasts of society at the time. So it was just really, I thought, really heartbreaking, and a really incredible play. And I don't think that it's just about the politics of the moment. I don't think that it's sort of a political screed. I think that it really is about this character. I think the Joe Mantello character in particular, Ned Weeks, is this kind of complicated, very typical New Yorker who it's about his search for love and the human need for love as much as it is about this disease. It's about what this disease says about how people approach relationships, about how AIDS is sort of this roadblock to any kind of human intimacy. So it sort of stands in between that. And I think that Ned's character kind of shows that in a really clear way. I love this show. I thought it was great.
All righty. Peter, what did you think about this?
I'm afraid there's another reference that's sadly dated, and that is when twice in the show, take him to St. Vincent's, the hospital that closed down a year ago, I think almost to the day. So that was sad as well. Frankly, I think this is as close to a perfect play as I've seen in a long time. I feel every word is in place. I think everything is tremendously moving. I think it's very interesting that Larry Kramer does not glamorize himself particularly.
Right.
And, you know, he really shows us the warts that he has and how he has difficulty dealing with other people, sometimes rightly, many times wrongly, that when you're dealing with a world where things must be accomplished, sometimes one has to compromise in ways that one doesn't want to, but if you don't get to the next step, nothing's going to happen at all, so maybe the time to compromise is now. And his reluctance to compromise is something that he looks at and examines, and I think he's fair to. So the cast, magnificent. Everything that has been said so far, I agree with. But to me, it was one of the most astonishing things in the season. And whenever I see Normal Heart, I saw it originally. I saw it 7 years ago when it was done at the Anspatcher down at the Papp Theater. But whenever I go, I'm still amazed at how much potency it has always had and how beautifully written it is. People don't often say that about this play, but I really think every word is in place, and I mean every word. So I am thrilled that it's on Broadway in such a magnificent production, and I do believe, to me, it was the highlight of the season.
Peter, Michael, or Lucky Mick, do you feel that this is, do you know if any text has been changed from the original production to here?
No, I believe not, but it's interesting you say that, James, because several people have noted that the play feels much shorter, and that the running time seems to be considerably shorter. It's about 2.5, and I think it was closer to 3 originally. And I noticed during the show, people were talking very, very quickly, especially in the first act. But it didn't seem too quickly. I mean, it just seemed that it really gave an extra jolt to the dialogue. And, of course, they're in the middle of a crisis, so it seemed very appropriate. So I think that was a wonderful choice on the part of the actors and the directors. And I believe that that's the case. I don't think that there have been any changes at all in the text or cuts. And it's only the running time is less only because of the pacing.
Who directed the original production? Look it up here.
I should know that.
Well, damn you, Michael.
Get off. You're fine.
Yeah. Okay. You're not getting paid this week. it was group directed. This production was group directed by Joel Grey and who else?
George C. Wolf.
Yeah. So, it is interesting because I haven't seen anybody in an analysis of The Normal Heart say that this has been updated or cut, or we're not having the same discussions that we had, say, when Chorus Line opened up, and that I remember the three of us, Michael and Peter and I, talking about how some of the text in Chorus Line felt dated, but it doesn't feel as though that it's this way in The Normal Heart. So we have a lot of popular shows that are. Would you call this a very strong play season?
Yes.
Michael, Peter.
Oh yeah.
Lucky
Vic. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I mean, we were just saying that is how we think that the musicals this year have been, with a couple of really key exceptions, kind of a disappointment. But plays like Jerusalem and The Normal Heart and. What are some of the others that we've seen?
Did you see War Horse out of Arcadia?
War Horse indeed.
Arcadia, we really loved. So we just thought that really strong. Bengal Tiger is great.
Intelligent Homosexual.
Yeah, Intelligent Homosexual, which is off Broadway, was great. So
Let's interrupt you for a second, Lucky and Mick. I think it was last night you went to go see Baby It's You, which is the other show that opened on the same night as The Normal Heart. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Baby It's You, and being that it's a musical, is it one of our stronger ones this season?
I would say not. Baby It's You is the story of, well, it's a jukebox musical filled with songs by the Shirelles, but lots of other artists from the late 50s and early 60s. I feel like whatever the creators could license, they did. And it is the story of, her name is Frances Greenberg.
Florence
Greenberg, sorry. Her name is Florence Greenberg, and she was a New Jersey housewife who basically sort of left home when her children were, her son was, I believe, on the verge of graduating from high school, and her daughter was a little bit older, and decided to go back to New York City and be a record producer and founded her own record label. And she actually was responsible for discovering the Shirelles, who were, they were friends with her daughter, and her daughter recommended that they audition for her, and she sort of turned them into stars. A lot of other things happen in this show that are sort of like the Shirelles sort of put on a semi-concert throughout the course of the show, but like only sort of. It's a strange show, and it's very, it turns all of these performers about whose music you're hearing all night, it sort of turns them into weird kind of background characters while we're hearing Florence's story. And the focus really is Florence's story, which is kind of amazing because she's not nearly as famous or as interesting as the people that she discovered. I would not say that this is one of the best shows of the season by any stretch of the imagination.
Particularly in contrast to opening the same night as The Normal Heart, which I think Michael wanted.
Okay, Michael, you want to fill us in on your feeling on Baby It's You?
It's hard to discuss it without being libelous. The two people who are responsible for the book of this, their names are Floyd Mutrux, I guess that's how you pronounce it, and Colin S. Scott.
Isn't it?
And the show was also conceived by Mr. Mutrux and choreographed by Brigitte Mutrux, who I assume is maybe his wife or sister or whatever, and directed by Mutrux and Sheldon Epps, who I don't know why he ever got within 10,000 miles of this. The book, quote unquote, is disgusting. The dialogue is so ridiculous. I cannot possibly even describe it to you. I should have written down some of the lines. If I were to,
I believe one of the lines was, "Does my butt look big?"
Yeah.
Memorable.
I was encouraged that there are some young theater students that I know who happen to be at the performance, and apparently they already have a moniker for the show, Baby It's Poo. I mean, it's excrement. It's disgusting. It should not be anywhere near Broadway. The lines are a second grader with a learning disability could write a better book than this. And the sad thing is that apparently these two people, Floyd Mutrux and Colin Escott, have other jukebox musical bio things, horrible, awful things in the pipeline. So their first one, Million Dollar Quartet, has been quite successful, not to do anything to do with their contribution to it, but just because of some amazing performances. And so that, I guess, gave them license and producer money to do future ones, but they really have to be stopped because this is ridiculous. Maybe they will be stopped because, as many listeners may have read, if I may quote from Playbill .com story by Kenneth Jones, a complaint on behalf of artists living and dead has been filed against the producers of the new Broadway musical Baby It's You. The complaint seeks damages on behalf of world-famous performers Beverly Lee of the Shirelles, Dionne Warwick, and Chuck Jackson, as well as the estates of original Shirelles Doris Coley Jackson and Addie Harris Jackson, for the unauthorized use of their names and likenesses in connection with the new Broadway show Baby It's You. So maybe the law will stop them, even if critics can't.
Well, it looks like box office might stop them, but let's... I just want to revert back to Normal Heart just for a minute, if we can use
Michael
that as
Lindsay Hogg directed it, by the way.
Yes, I was going to say Michael Lindsay Hogg directed it. I'm looking at a review from 1985 by Frank Rich in The Times, and I didn't realize that the Times had become a story itself about their coverage of the AIDS epidemic and crisis. And that played into Frank Rich's review as well. When you guys went to the theater and saw the show, did you run into Larry Kramer handing out flyers?
I did. Yes, he was outside. Yes.
He wasn't there, but other people were afterwards. Also, the letter that the wonderful, powerful letter that he wrote is included in the press kit for those who received the press kit. And you know, the night I went, Dr. Ruth Westheimer was in the audience, and I forgot that she's mentioned in the play. So that was that was really nice.
Didn't she also mention in Angels in America?
Yes. She's alluded to. She's not mentioned. There's a line about sex. There's some woman on TV, some little German woman talking about sex. It's a line like that, and we put the rest of it together.
If only Dr. Ruth were a nun, we could tie this all into a cute package.
Hey, do you know who's been mentioned perhaps more times than anybody else in the history of Broadway? Troy Donahue, because don't forget he's mentioned in Chorus Line.
Oh, yeah.
And he's also Grease, indeed. So as a result, when you add up the runs of those shows, he's been mentioned on Broadway about 15,000 times. Not bad for somebody who wouldn't be remembered in any way, shape, or form otherwise.
Lauren Bacall is in Baby and Evita, and I think a couple of other shows.
Sure. Lauren Bacall's done well, too. Right.
I'm going to figure out how I can get my name into Mamma Mia. All right. Okay, let's move forward after that sorbet of... discussion on the Normal Heart to cleanse us of the Baby It's You. All right.
Well, I want to say, though, however, oh, yeah, about Baby It's You, what I want to say is Beth Lebel's marvelous.
Oh, yes.
She's really terrific in playing this role and giving it everything she's got. It's a tough character because she's not particularly sympathetic. And in a way, Baby It's You may tell the truth more than some other shows do because she seems to be all out for herself. She doesn't worry about her kids. She doesn't worry about her husband. She doesn't worry about hurting the feelings of the people she's representing. When she deals with the Shirelles when they're on their way lay down, she essentially says, it's over, but you had a good time, didn't you? That isn't the dialogue. I won't suggest it is. But that's her attitude. You know, things come, things go, you know, and that's all there is to it. So, but she does it extraordinarily well. And it's easy to predict she'll get a Tony nomination on Tuesday because this has not been a strong year for female roles in musical theater.
Right.
But nevertheless, I think even in a strong year, she might sneak in.
She deserves better than this show. Another thing.
Oh, yeah.
Quickly about the show, another thing that's ridiculous about it is the doubling. Did anyone notice that? I mean, there are the four women who play the Shirelles, but at one point, three of them play another group. I can't remember which one at the moment.
Group and then, being the and, Romantics.
And, thank
and
you.
One of them is Dionne Warwick as well.
Yes, and one of them is Dionne Warwick. I mean, come on. Okay. We understand cost cutting and keeping cast size down, but that's ridiculous. Well, I told a friend about that. He said that's like having MAME double as Sally Cato.
I think it's a sort of troubling social commentary that they don't necessarily mean to be making about these artists, that these people are completely faceless and interchangeable.
Interchangeable,
and
yes.
Unfair to the artist, which is one of the big problems of the show, I think.
Yeah.
All righty. So if we could just go back and do it again, what would we do? Peter, why don't you tell us about Born Yesterday?
Born Yesterday, a 1946 hit, and one that became one of the longest-running plays in the history of theater at that time. I think only four or five shows had ever run longer at that point, which was pretty impressive. Garson Kanin's comedy about a dumb blonde who thinks that she's got a great life because she's taken care of, never mind that her boyfriend is quite a terrible man who is an industrialist who's very proud of himself for working himself up from nothing, and never mind that he may have had to cheat and cut corners to do it, but now he's at a point where he can really buy and sell politicians, and he's going to do it, and she's going to stand idly by because she doesn't even know what's going on. However, now that they're in Washington, the problem is that indeed they are going to be meeting some high-class people, and now her boyfriend, Harry Brock, is very, very concerned that she's going to say the wrong thing. So he hires a reporter to come in and educate her. Well, a little learning is a dangerous thing, of course. Now, what's really astonishing is the fact that playing the role of Billy Dawn, as the girl is named, is Nina Arianda, who about 2 years ago, I dare say none of us had ever heard of. This is one of the quickest rises in theater history, in the sense of in about 800 days, maybe even fewer, this woman has gone from somebody totally obscure to somebody whose name is above the title in a great big Broadway show. And not only that, at the performance I was at anyway, sometimes this changed. Jim Belushi, who after all, in his bio says he's made 74 films, he's a famous guy, gives her the last bow. So this has been quite a speedy success story. So, and it's deserved, because she's marvelous as Billy Dawn, starting out as an insecure young woman who has downcast eyes, watch for those, and the slackest of jaws. But oh, how she learns. And it's great when she's learning and she makes a little bit of a mistake. Like at one point she says, what's the diff? Which she realized she should be saying, what's the difference? And she looks so ashamed of herself. And yet what glee she shows at her newfound skills and what delight and pride she displays when she can add something she's learned to the conversation. Billy is said to be a former member of a Broadway chorus. And as we learned, lo, those many years ago from Chorus Line, the rank and file ensemble members of Broadway shows are no dummies. I don't know if there's going to be a market for Born Yesterday in the sense that one can see the excellent 1950 movie that won Judy Holliday an Oscar. I also have a great deal of affection for one that was made substantially later with Don Johnson and Melanie Griffith and John Goodman. Most people don't like it because it veers away from the original text a great deal. But I think it points out some marvelous things, too. But if you want the original, see it at the Court Theater. A lot of people have criticized the set. Oh, my God, it's so garish. Yes, but that's the type of set that Harry, the type of hotel room, that suite that Harry Brock would want. So it's right for the character. So I hope it goes over. I always worry about shows that are easily available on Netflix in one form or another. Maybe the fact that it's a black and white movie will get people to go to the theater, because we do live in an age where people fear black and white movies. So, but yeah, I had a very nice time at Bonn yesterday.
All righty. Lucky and Mick, what did you think about Bonn yesterday?
We actually really enjoyed Bonn yesterday. I think that it was a particularly interesting night for us. We had just gone to see The Intelligent Homosexuals Guide Downtown the night before, which is very, very long and serious and heavy and thoughtful. And it took me personally a few minutes to transition into this show, because it's such a different type of play. But I had a wonderful time, and I thought that Nina Arianda was absolutely arresting. She was wonderful. We had not seen her before in Venus and Fur Downtown. As Peter pointed out, she's had sort of a meteoric rise to the point that this seems to be a vehicle for her, that they've brought famous people in to get her attention.
And she's doing this kind of Betty Boop, dumb blonde voice in the show that goes such a long way, I think, toward creating this character. And her timing is completely amazing. I mean, she lands like every single joke. I mean, she really is almost the whole show. I think the other performances kind of fade into the background, and it's not just because, you know, she looks amazing. She's in all the beautiful costumes. It's not just that. The performance is kind of larger than life. I think the only thing that competes with her up on that stage is actually the set, which gets like its own entrance applause, which I always think is really funny. Like I always kind of roll my eyes when that happened. I'm like, oh, well, we also have to watch the show now too. But I think the whole show is her. I think without her, I think that Belushi's performance is great. I think it's a really solid performance. I think he does well playing this character that's not very likable. I mean, there's a point when he hits her in the show, and it's like, it's repulsive. I mean, the audience has such a negative reaction. And, you know, I think he, you know, walks the line of like dealing with that really terrible stuff and dealing with the kind of the kind of more jocular, funny stuff that the character says too. But the whole show is her. I think without her, I don't really know what the other reason would be to see the show besides her.
But how could it be? She's not a Hollywood star. We have to have Hollywood stars in order to make our shows, right?
It's a little bit of a depressing commentary in its own way that they had to bring in like Jim Belushi and Robert Sean Leonard to get this woman, you know,
Her on a stage.
But right. She proves that you can have a theater actor or actress and they can carry a show and just be, she's unbelievable.
Yeah. Peter, is she eligible for a Theater World Award, or what's her background?
She already won one. She won one for Venus and Fur. I hope she's going to present this year. I love when somebody who wins in one year then presents the next year. So, no, she's all taken care of. You can only win that award once. While we do have a situation where if you make an off-Broadway debut and do not win, you are then eligible if you make your Broadway debut. We do that, but once you win, that's the end of it. I'm looking forward to her presenting this year. I think that'd be great. But I'll point out that I thought Jim Belushi was terrific too. And by the way, he really resembles greatly, for better or worse, Broderick Crawford in the movie version. So that was kind of interesting to me too. I really felt that I was seeing almost a reincarnation. And I'm not saying he's doing a Broderick Crawford imitation. That's not what I mean. What I only mean is that he happens to resemble Broderick Crawford quite a bit. So that's a pretty impressive performance by him. And I like Robert Sean Leonard too. So, and by the way, if we're going to be talking about the cast, I have to go to bat for somebody who I don't think would be noticed by very many people, because really, when you come right down to it, how often does it happen that a maid turns out to be quite wonderful? But the first person you see on stage, a woman named Jennifer Regan, whoever she may be, is terrific as the maid. So enjoy her as well. I think she's quite sensational.
There was a wonderful maid in the Blight Spirit revival too, wasn't there?
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, you know, yes. there are no small parts, only small actors.
So they tell us.
Peter, I want to get back to something that you said before. So it's possible I could still win a Theater World Award?
Have you made your off-Broadway debut?
Yeah, but not my Broadway debut.
Broadway debut. Yep, yeah. You're eligible.
Okay. I'm going to work on that.
Yes.
To see if I can see if I can get into Baby It's You. All righty.
I think you should go for Mamma Mia.
Well, you know, which of the fathers would I be? Oh my goodness, we're degenerating quickly here. But I wanted to talk about. So we have Chris Rock, we have Robert Sean Leonard, we have Jim Belushi, we have Edie Falco and Ben Stiller, and this is going to be a huge...
Oh, yeah. Robin Williams.
Robin Williams and various other people that have come to the Great White Way in the recent months.
Yeah, but just for the record, guys, I mean, Robert Sean Leonard has lots of theater credit.
Oh, yeah. Yes. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
No, right. But post-house. You know,
okay.
Actually, I think he did one other show post house, but no, certainly Robert Sean Leonard has been on Broadway and
he's ours first.
Yes. We need to actually get House Hugh Laurie. We need to get him to Broadway because he is quite the song and dance guy. He is.
I know. I'm just laughing. Well, wasn't he was discussed as a possible contender for the role of Henry Higgins in this supposed film remake of My Fair Lady.
Oh, I think he'd be great.
Yeah. He seems physically miscast, but I would like to see that.
Yeah. He's got deep blue eyes, doesn't he? Speaking of blue, so House of Blue Leaves.
Very well done.
To end up our discussion this morning. Michael, why don't you give us the intro there?
Oh, well, can Peter start?
Yeah. Peter, why don't you give us the introduction?
Sorry.
That's okay.
Well, why not? Well, I'll tell you the first thing that came to mind while watching House of Blue Leaves. It's a play that takes place on October 4th, 1965. So it's a play that involves a songwriter who believes that, like James Marino, that there's still time to make a stunning debut.
Absolutely.
That he's been writing songs, and he has this one friend in Hollywood who he really believes is going to save him. His songs are, even for 1965, unbearably retro and tremendously corny. They're fun to listen to from our standpoint, but they don't seem to have much popular appeal in an age where the Beatles have taken over. So we don't believe in him as a songwriter. He's also married to a woman who seems a little unbalanced, and yet, as in so many situations, including Shakespeare with fools, she turns out to be wise every now and then and comes out with a line that really puts him in his place and rings of truth. He's cheating on her with another woman. So he's trading in a woman named Bananas for somebody named Bunny. And Bunny has no compunction whatsoever about insulting Bananas and really feeling that she has title to this man. In the midst of all this, I should have mentioned that our hero's name is Artie Shaughnessy, and Artie has a son named Ronnie, who's been in the service, but now he's AWOL, because on this day, on this October 4th, 1965, the Pope is coming and is going to be saying a mass at the stadium, and as a result, he is planning to blow up the entire situation, including the Pope. He's going to make a big statement here on how discontent he is. In a way, this play is tougher to take in this era where such things happen. Today is also the anniversary of that Times Square incident last year where a car was set to go off with a bomb. So it's a little more dour a situation than it had been back in 1971 when it was first produced, or even 20-odd years ago when it was revived. And I think that may be one reason why David Cromer has directed it more as a serious play than a knockabout, drag-down farce. The thing that bothered me as a historian is that at one point, people talk to the audience quite often in this play, and Ronnie, the bomber, apologizes to the audience at one point and says, "I'm sorry you had to hear that. Pay $70 or $80 to hear that." Well, the original line said by William Atherton, by the way, in 1971 was "pay $7 or $8 to hear that." And given that the play has not been updated and still takes place in 1965, I think the lower figures should have been used. So, also, you know, I'll tell you, it always happens whenever long ago ticket prices are mentioned, they always get a laugh. I mean, think of 42nd Street. The moment the curtain goes up and you see people dancing, somebody says something like, "Well, the audience is sure going to get their $4.40 worth," you know, and the audience certainly lets out with a shriek because when 42nd Street opened, after all, they had to pay $25 for those orchestra seats. Though it quickly went up to 30 and then 35. So I'm surprised that they did that, that they changed it to 70 or 80s. Anyway, it's a strange production in that it has been directed as a more serious play, but every now and then the farcical elements do seem to squeeze through, and it turns out to be neither fish nor fowl. So I think Ben Stiller is very good. Edie Falco's terrific, yes indeed. Jennifer Jason Leigh, wonderful. They're all very good in what they're doing, but it does seem to be a little bit of, well, a submarine sandwich made of meatballs with whipped cream on top, and that's not that good a meal.
All righty. Michael, what did you think about House of Blue Leaves?
Well, I don't have much to add. I had only seen one previous production of the show, actually a college production many years ago, I suppose just a couple of years after the original. And I, you know, I'm not a fan of John Guare. I really have decided that. I just don't like his dialogue. I don't like his characters. I think he is very inconsistent in terms of tone. The way that, you know, direct address to the audience is often considered to be a lazy way of playwriting, and I think that applies here, especially the way it goes back and forth in a way that doesn't seem organic. This play also has a lot of pop cultural references to things that were popular in the 60s, and most of which we still heard of today. And that, I think, is considered cheap and lazy also. There has been criticism of this production that it downplayed the comedy and played up the darker aspects. I would agree with that. I think it would have been much more palatable if the comedy had been played up, but I question the quality of the material itself. Ben Stiller somehow seemed miscast to me. I'm told by the person I went with that John Mahoney was wonderful in the role. His acting was fine. He just seemed miscast. He still reads quite young to me, even though I suppose he's actually close to the actual age of the character would be. But I will say Edie Falco, I thought, was wonderful in the part of Bananas. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bananas.
Yeah, Banana.
We never know what her real name is. I can't believe it is Bananas, but it never comes up.
And another standout for me was actually Hallie Pfeiffer, who played one of the three nuns. I just thought she had so much charisma and just such an amazing presence on stage. Keep your eye out for further things from Hallie Pfeiffer. I thought she was really wonderful.
All righty. So that kind of wraps up our review of the five shows we're talking about this week. I wanted to point out that today we say goodbye to La Cage, the revival on Broadway, which... any parting words for it?
Well,
Lucky Mick, what were you saying?
I'm sorry to lose Christopher Sieber. I think he was wonderful.
He died?
See him more.
No.
God.
The stage. No. He's not starting humor.
I'm sure he'll be back in something. You know, if not Mamma Mia.
Hush up, I now don't you cry. He'll be back another day.
Yeah, I'm sorry the show didn't last long. I'm sure it's just a question of competition. So much has opened in the past couple of weeks, few weeks and months. It's insane.
I think Chicago aside, in this era of revivals, which essentially started in 1971, I don't think, aside from Chicago, any revival has run longer than the original production. So as a result, about a year is what you can really hope for most of these things.
That's too. I mean, there was just another revival of La Cage that I feel like happened about 10 years ago. So.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that too.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so let's wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio section where there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of This Week on Broadway and Broadway Radio, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you are not a fan of iTunes, as there are many out there that are not, you can also subscribe to this in the Zune Marketplace. Listen to it on your Zune or your Windows 7 mobile phone. You can also subscribe in Google's Listen application for your Android phones. Or you can listen on Stitcher Radio, Stitcher Radio, which is an application that downloads to many devices, and you can listen to us without syncing, which is always a fun thing. If you prefer to listen to us on your on the website, you can go to Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7, and Saturdays at 2 p.m., where they play our podcast. We thank them for that. And you can also go to BroadwayStars.com/radio and see all the previous episodes. One thing I did not mention last week, and I still quite haven't figured out, is I think last week was our 100th episode.
Really?
We did 100 of these, yes, over the last two plus years. Yeah. I still can't figure out the numbering, but it's somewhere around 100. I think it was last week or the week before was number 100. So let's see. Michael, anything coming up for you? What's going on?
Well, you know what I wanted to talk about at one future podcast is the wonderful reissues that have been coming from Sony BMG. I know Peter works for them, so but if he wouldn't mind, maybe we could talk about those a little bit because some of them are really
good. I'm sure that after the Tonys are over, we're going to have some downtime. We can start covering some recordings and things like that. That'd
yes.
be great. Peter, what's going on in your world? Anything exciting? I know you have Theater World Awards coming up. You're busy with that?
Yeah, we're right in the middle of voting. I have heard from three of the seven voters thus far. So I already see who's going to win some awards. I mean, there has been one person, and this will be for you to figure out, but there has been one person that the three people who have voted so far have voted as their top choice. What we do is we ask for six choices of men and six choices of women, and you give 6 points to your favorite choice, five to your next, four to your next, etc. So far, there's one person who has an 18. You know, all three people have voted 6 points to this person.
Wow.
And I'll let you determine who it is.
Hugh
so
Jackman.
Right, Hugh Jackman indeed. You know, so a retro award. Actually, he won one of ours, which is no surprise, way back when. But anyway, so yes, we're in the middle of voting for that, and we're going to announce, I think, on May 10th, who the winners are. This year, we also are giving an ensemble award. The LaFontaine Foundation, Aaron Frankel, have asked us to do that. And we also give a Dorothy Loudon Award, because Dorothy Loudon was a winner back in 1963 for a flop show called Nowhere to Go But Up, which indeed was the case for Dorothy Loudon. And that was, you know, I mean, eight performances and out. And yet, isn't it interesting that John Willis and Daniel Blum said that lady is going to be something, and they picked her out of an eight-performance flop. That's pretty impressive. So we give an award now to somebody we missed along the way, somebody who may have been ineligible for one reason or another. The flaw in the system is that so many times people come in and they replace. For example, last year, Bontigo Glover wasn't eligible because she had replaced in Color Purple. She was playing the lead. You know, I mean, that was her Broadway debut. Let's face it, if you're playing the Celie in The Color Purple, you have made your Broadway debut, you know. So, but we didn't get to see her, you know. So as a result, somebody like that is somebody we reconsider and give the Dorothy Loudon Award to. So that's, anyway, the awards are going to be on June 7th, probably at the August Wilson Theater. The ink is wasn't on the contract yet, but that's what it looks like. And I'll be hosting the ceremonies, which I love doing every year, and we'll see what happens.
So what you're saying is that twice during this podcast, I have found out that I could be a possible future hopeful Theater World Award nominee.
Now, you keep saying that. You keep saying that.
Well, you know how to reach a goal is you say it out loud, you write it down, and then you achieve it.
Yeah, so, James, even if you make your Broadway debut when we missed you, you might get the Dorothy Loudon.
I could come back.
Yeah, right, sure. So I tell you, we leave you with hope today, James.
I want you all to go and go watch Oprah's episode on the secret, because that's what the secret is. You say it out loud and you write it down, and then it happens. That's so Lucky and the Mick, take us out of this. what's going on? No. What's going on your side?
Well, for the next couple of weeks, we are all Tonys all the time. For the next couple of weeks, we're really excited to hear the nominations this week. We're really excited to be indignant over whoever gets snubbed. And also, too, another thing that's like really important in our world is that Jonathan Groff is coming back to Glee. So our readers care very much about that. That's just that's a fancy way of saying that we care a lot about that. So we'll be covering that a lot.
I keep hearing about Patty going into Glee.
Yeah, she's going to be in the season finale, which I'll watch it.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Shut the front door. All righty. So I'm very excited that you joined us this morning.
Thank you.
And Mick, we really appreciate you taking some time out of a Sunday morning, which is typically reserved for sleep.
Not my best hour, I'll say, but we tried for you this morning.
Well, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
All righty. So I guess that's it. Contact information on the BroadwayStars.com/radio, that's the This Week on Broadway page. We have all contact information for Peter, Michael, Lucky, and the Mick. They're all there. You can get to the Craptacular, become a fan of it on Facebook, and follow it on Twitter, and see the snarky little witticisms that they write all the time, which is how I found them. And I really enjoy it. Also, Peter, last week we talked about making a central repository of all your work, and I made that happen. So if you go to peterfelicia.com, you can see stuff that Peter has written. I'm going to try to make that all-encompassing for all the different outlets that Peter writes for, and so we can have a central place to find Peter at all times.
Bless
you. On behalf of myself, I am James Marino, a future Hopeful Theater World Award nominee. I'd like to say thank you. And everybody say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye all.